How many times have you heard a movie is alright, it's average, it's just okay? If you ask your friends if you should see it and they say, meh. I'm Davey Barris and he's Darren Cross. And on this show, we'll break down and review these movies and decide once and for all if these meh movies are good or bad and whether or not you should watch them. Because on this show, there are no meh movies. Now, of course, for a movie to be meh, it must be between 40 and 60 on the tomato meter on Rotten Tomatoes, or between 4 and 6 on IMDb. And the movie we are doing this week, celebrating its 20-year anniversary, and oh boy, does the technology in the movie show it, we are doing 2001's Vanilla Sky, which scored a 42% on Rotten Tomatoes and a 6.9 on IMDb, making it a meh movie. Spoiler warning, of course, spoiler warning for Vanilla Sky. And while we're at it, spoiler warning for the Spanish movie, Open Your Eyes. You'll understand in a second. Darren, in case it's been a while since they've seen it or they've never seen it before, what is Vanilla Sky all about?
Vanilla Sky is about our main character, who's played by Tom Cruise, named David Ames? I think it's Ames, yeah.
A lot of vowels in there.
Ames. who is, he has inherited his father's company, so he's kind of a wealthy, he's in his early 30s, I think he's 33 if I'm not mistaken.
He is.
Has inherited his father's company, his publishing company. You know, he's sort of living the life in New York City, and he is part of a car crash with a woman who is intentionally trying to kill herself, and he gets disfigured on his face, and so he's not quite as pretty as he used to be, and you know, consequences ensue from this accident.
Wow, that's an interesting, those are the details you decided to go with, because mm-hmm. I don't want to be in your shoes. I don't want to try to surmise this movie without, you know, completely spoiling it, without completely getting into the details, because it's complicated. We'll just say that it is complicated. You will see as we get into this. Hopefully you've seen it, because we're going to talk about it and spoil everything, especially mm-hmm. in a movie like this, a psychological mind-bending movie. We will spoil everything, so make sure you've seen it. All right, Darren, the first question we ask of all our meh movies is, did the movie do what it was supposed to do? And Vanilla Sky, considered a science fiction psychological thriller. I've heard it called a reality warp. An odd mixture of science fiction, romance, and reality warp. Darren, did the movie do what it was supposed to do?
I said yes to this. I thought it checked all the boxes of what it was promising to be. There's certainly romance. It's certainly science fiction-y, as we'll get into, because there's a lot of odd things that happen. And then I think psychological thriller is a fair bet, because there's a lot of things that happen that just don't make sense in the real world. And so you're kind of left wondering what the hell's going on. So I said, yeah, it did do what it was supposed to do.
Yeah, I would agree. It did do what it was supposed to do as far as the genres go. I think the trailer sold it more of a thriller. I don't know if the thriller aspect, it doesn't seem until like the last maybe 15 minutes of the movie, they're really like running around. I think it was a tagline, or the trailer said something like he's the detective of his own life. And I'm like, maybe in like the last 10, 15 minutes, up until that point, it's more of a romance, isn't it? Would you say a sci-fi fair. Psychological romance kind of thing? So I would say it did what it was supposed to do. It was definitely the mind-bending movie that it was advertised as. It took the appropriate amount of twists and turns that I was expecting it to take. So I'm with you on that. All right, Darren, the next category on the No Meh Movies podcast is, did the actors bring it? And we have an incredibly talented, high-profile cast here. We've got Tom Cruise as David Ames. We've got Penelope Cruz, different spelling, as Sophia Sereno. We've got Cameron Diaz as Julie Gianni. We got Kurt Russell as Dr. Curtis McCabe. And we've got Jason Lee as Brian Shelby. And then a few other recognizable names and faces. Noah Taylor, Tilda Swinton, Michael Shannon is in this that you might pick out in this cast. Oh, and Conan Bryan is himself. That's important. And Steven Spielberg is himself. That's important. They made the cast list here on Wikipedia. The interesting thing about this, and I mentioned it up top, is that this is a remake of a Spanish film called Open Your Eyes that came out in 97. And in the role of Sophia in that Spanish film is also Penelope Cruz. She reprised the role in the American remake, which I find fascinating. So, Darren, with this cast, who do you have as your top performer? Which of these actors brought it?
It was actually kind of a tough choice for me, but I almost went with Cameron Diaz because she goes like to the covers like the whole spectrum of emotions with the characters that she plays in this.
All right, that's fair.
But in the end, I decided to go with our lead, who's Tom Cruise. I thought he did a good job. I thought I was very believable role as far as like being this kind of New York, I don't want to say hot shot, but rich young New Yorker.
I think they call him Playboy.
Playboy. Yeah, sure. Just sort of like does whatever he wants, has all the money he needs to do whatever he wants. And then as the movie goes on and he gets in the car crash and he's sort of disfigured, I liked his role of how he handled that and the emotions he displayed dealing with that. And I thought it was very believable. I enjoyed it. I think in general, Tom Cruise is a pretty good actor. You know, he certainly had his flops, but yeah, I liked him in this, so I decided to go with him for my top.
All right. I'm going to save my thoughts on Tom Cruise for successes and failures.
Okay.
I'll leave it at that. My top performer, we do tend to lean towards the people in the starring roles. Obviously, they have the most meat, the most dialogue, the most things to do. I'm actually going with a smaller role for my top performer. I'm going with Kurt Russell, who played Dr. Curtis McCabe, the psychologist, which is kind of the framing device for the movie. Again, to get into quick details, Tom Cruise's character has been arrested for a murder, and Kurt Russell is the psychologist who's interviewing him, trying to get to the bottom of what's going on here. In some very creepy, weird scenes where Tom Cruise is wearing the artificial face mask, and I just thought Kurt Russell brought this like really authoritative energy to the role where I believed him as a psychologist, as a researcher, as someone trying to get to the bottom of another human being's mind who was taking this serious. I believed him as a dad who was kind of admiring the Playboy life of Tom Cruise, and especially believed him at the end when he's the character that's trying to, and again, spoiler warning, who's trying to keep the dream alive. Like, he's the one who's, like, trying to keep the fabric of this world together and keep Tom Cruise's character, David, in it. And it really breaks him down. Like, when they ask him, you know, what are the names of your daughters, and he can't answer, it's a great performance, I thought. And it blows my mind that Kurt Russell, the guy who could play, was Snake Plissken in Escape from New York? The guy who could play Captain Ron? The guy from The Thing, who survives The Thing, can play this psychologist so convincingly. Like, it's amazing that he could be such an action star, such an 80s action star, and such a down-to-earth, you know, character in a movie like this. So I gave Kurt Russell my top performer.
Nice. Yeah, I thought he did a good job. And it was refreshing to see him not, you know, just like machine gunning or like being like a... being like a drunkard or something like that, or
not to take anything away from the two female leads, because I think they were both good. Cameron Diaz did have a wide range, but that was kind of the one thing her character had to do, was to have a wide range of emotion. And Penelope Cruz's character, kind of the only thing she had to do was to be sweet and sensual. So
yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, I feel like there were more interesting things that the male characters had to do in this movie than those two. Not to take anything away from their performances, because they were both very convincing. All right, Darren. Now, normally we'd move into successes and failures here, but I kind of want to introduce something new. It's something we talked about in between seasons 2 and 3 of the podcast, and that's bringing up themes, introducing themes. So this is going to kind of lead us into successes and failures. Sometimes a theme can be a big overarching thought. Sometimes a theme can be a couple of small things that are laced throughout the movie. Darren, what were you picking up? What were the themes or the theme that spoke to you in this movie?
Yeah, I had a couple, and maybe we could bounce back and forth a little bit, but the first one I wanted to mention was, I thought one of the themes was just sort of making people understand that your decisions and kind of the way that you treat people has consequences, potentially. And so you can't kind of, even if you feel a certain way, you can't just kind of go around doing and saying whatever you want and not expect others to react to that and maybe react to it negatively.
Definitely the interactions between David and Cameron Diaz's character, Julie, and then his mm-hmm. best friend, Jason Lee, mm-hmm. definitely represent that. So yeah, I would agree with that one. And do you want to call it a success or a failure?
I would call it a success if I had to name it. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the reason that Julie, who's played by Cameron Diaz, kind of goes crazy and intentionally crashes the car is that she feels obviously very strongly about their relationship and feels like David is sort of just doesn't care. Like, he just sees it as a physical thing that's not going to really go anywhere. And she is obviously much more serious than that.
Right. The big line from her is like, even if you didn't make a promise, your body makes a promise when you sleep with someone. And I was like, okay, that's interesting. That made me reflect a little bit on my youth.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone would agree that, like, you know, there is this somewhat of an emotional connection or bond that is created, and just, it depends on, I guess, I think this is why these things have to be discussed between two people, right? There needs yes. to be a clear understanding of where things stand. So that one person's not way over here, another person's way over there.
It's probably better to have those discussions not at 75 miles per hour in New York City traffic.
True, true.
All right, so for me, it was kind of one big overarching thing, and it gets said a bunch of times, mostly by Jason Lee's character, Brian, the best friend. And it's this whole concept of life can't be sweet without the sour. So they talk about sweet and sour all the time. This whole concept of, like, a dream feels too good. It feels too good, so it can't be real. And so they feel false, almost. If the world feels false if things are too perfect. So that's the kind of the theme that I saw overarching throughout this movie, that for life to feel real, there needs to be the bad with the good. There needs to be the pain with the joy. There needs to be the sorrow with the happiness. So that was kind of the theme, that every scene where things were too perfect, where things were too good, where the perfect girl and the perfect scenario and the perfect dialogue, right, that was stuff that was all the dream. It wasn't real, and it didn't feel real to him, or it felt off to him, because there was nothing sour there. There was nothing to balance it out. And when the dream kind of turns into the nightmare, they talk a lot about the subconscious and the subconscious balancing things out, or the subconscious has a way of reacting. And I thought that was the subconscious correcting for things feeling too perfect. So when the world got too perfect, he had to add, his subconscious had to add sour into it to keep this dream. And he's supposed to be in a dream. Like, that's the point of the movie, is he's supposed to be in this dream, in this happy state, in this ideal state. And the subconscious won't allow it to happen because it feels too perfect. So that was kind of the big overarching theme that I kind of pulled away from it.
Yeah, it's definitely a big one. And it's Yeah, it's very nicely worded.
Thank you.
Like they, I like that it's said a lot throughout the movie too about the sweet and sour thing. I think it's a good analogy.
I feel like we should have been eating Sour Patch Kids while we watch this movie. That would have only been appropriate. That's the appropriate snack. We'll have to add that as a category sometime. What's the appropriate movie snack for this movie?
Oh, this candy is so sweet. Oh, there's the sour. Oh.
I would give that a success, too. I think that theme was pretty clearly defined throughout the movie, so I give that a success.
The other one that I had was just kind of about vanity and sort of, you know, materialistic things. And it's true, I think, that as people, we, you know, some of us take that more seriously than others. But I think any one of us, you know, there's a certain amount of psychological damage and psychological health that's affected when something materialistic or your vanity or the way you look is one way for a long time and then it suddenly changes. You know, you feel very self-conscious. There's a lot of, you know, whether or not all of it's true, I think that can have a big psychological impact on a person.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I, for some reason, I've shattered my nose. You weren't there. You were at an adjacent softball field, but I've shattered my nose. And for some reason, the reconstruction of my nose never bothered me like the way it bothers Tom Cruise. But I did think of an example where we could feel this in everyday life, because even though you don't get to see us, Darren and I both have beards. And have you ever had one of those days where you're like shaving your beard, you know, trimming your beard, and you're like, bring a little too much off one side, or you bring one side up a little too high, and you're like, damn it, I can't fix this. I'm just going to have to walk. Like, it bothers you. It's kind of in the back of your mind for like the next 2 days that like,
yep. Yeah,
something's off. Something's off.
Yeah. And I mean, that's exactly like being in a horrific car accident.
For some reason, the broken nose never bothered me like that.
Yeah, but you didn't have lasting facial damage.
There's a little bump there. There's a little scar from the stitch. Yeah. All right. Moving deeper into my successes and failures. A fail for me in this movie is, and I'm going to assume, I don't know, you tell me what you assume, and I'm going to tell you what I assume, where the dream begins. From what I felt in the movie and from what they said, I'm going to believe the tech support guy. And I'm going to believe that the dream began after he passed out in the alley, after the nightclub scene. And he wakes up and she's there and she's being very sweet to him. And the sky's different. That's why. The sky is different. That's where I believe the dream begins.
Yeah, I agree. That's how I interpreted it too.
Okay, there are different interpretations. Cameron Crowe will tell you, and I think in the director's commentary, he says there's 5 different interpretations or something like that. So some people think the whole thing is a dream.
Right.
Some people think it begins right after the crash. So anyways, this, in theory, happens before the dream begins, before he's frozen, before the dream begins. The fact that he's even hanging out with Sophia, the fact that, like, Brian brings her to the party, he instantly hits on her, and maybe that's just joking because he's the playboy and, you know, Brian's okay with that. But then they go up to the second apartment and Brian confesses that like he really digs this girl. And then Tom Cruise, David walks her home in this whole, and she's like, she says a few things about Brian, but she doesn't really confront him about it. Like, it's never really confronted in the movie until that scene in the, when he's coming out of the police station, which is in a dream. Like, that's a complete dream sequence.
Right.
So it's never confronted that he kind of took his buddy's girl.
Yeah.
Like, just swiped her. And she was fine with it, too. Like, it's just, that was a fail for me that you're going to hurt your friend if you do that. Like, that's a kind of an a-hole move. So, yeah. The fact that they just go with it and no one seems to really care is kind of a fail for me.
Jason Lee's like, I knew this was gonna happen. It's fine. I'll move on with my life.
Yeah.
I'm gonna say the music, the soundtrack was a success of mine.
Good call.
I've discovered that I like movies that sort of use music that you would not suspect that would to be used in a scene. And you're like, this doesn't fit this. But then you're like, oh, and it kind of works, though.
Like Beach Boys' Good Vibrations?
Yeah, yeah, right. So he's like, there's a scene where he thinks he's in a building with a at the office of the place where he was frozen.
Life extensions.
And then he kind of freaks out and he runs back down into the lobby, and then the lobby's empty, like there was no one there at all in the first place. And he's kind of freaking out, and it's like Good Vibrations is playing by the Beach Boys. But it kind of worked. I don't know. Yeah. So overall, I thought the music and when the music was played was well chosen.
So it's no surprise because Cameron Crowe is the director. The soundtrack was done by Nancy Wilson, who's married to Cameron Crowe, and she's a musician. And so Cameron Crowe is known kind of for his musical influences in the movie. The movie he does right before this is Almost Famous, which is a rock band starring Jason Lee's one of the stars of that movie.
Yeah.
And so I'm not surprised that they were really on point with the music in this. He talks a lot about the influences of the Beatles and the song Revolution 9 in the making of this movie. So yeah, so I'm not surprised that worked, that clicked for you.
Yeah, I dug it.
All right, I'll give you a success. The big stunt of the movie, jumping the car off the bridge. That was a good stunt. That was a success for me. That is an image that I've remembered. I never saw this movie in 2001, but I remember that from the trailer. That is an image that stuck with me. I knew exactly what that looked like when that car goes off the bridge and hits nose first, grill first into the ground like that. That was a good car stunt, a good jump. It looked pretty brutal. And the way they filmed it on that still shot and like no one's really around, but then some people come running in the distance.
Yeah. And I like the silence of it, right? It's like a huge sound when it hits the wall, but then it's just like nothing, right? It's just complete silence until you sort of see the people reacting down the street.
Yeah, absolutely. So that was a success for me.
I guess this kind of ties into what you were saying about David stealing Ryan's, I don't want to say his girlfriend, but this girl that he decided that he liked a lot and brought to the party. I didn't like Brian and David's relationship that much in general.
Yeah.
It was like a weird thing where it's like maybe they were friends or not. Like it always felt awkward between the two of them. And I don't know if that was what they were going for, but it didn't seem like they were really that close. Like anytime they hung out, it was almost like they like hadn't seen each other in a really long time. And they're like, oh, so how's your life kind of thing? So, but they kept calling each other best friends. I don't know. Did not seem very genuine.
You felt a little bit of resentment from Brian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah, I didn't like their chemistry too much.
All right, moving on to a fail of mine. I told you I'd bring up Tom Cruise. Now, first off, the big fail for me is the shots of his face. And maybe, I wonder if Cameron Crowe did this on purpose, but the scars on his face, the bruising around his eye, his right eye, seemed to change from not even scene to scene, but shot to shot. Like in the nightclub, when he's talking to the bartender, it seemed way worse. And then when he's talking to Sophia, it seemed almost like barely there. I mean, like, I was thinking about Tina Fey, how sometimes you don't even notice her scar on her face is there. It just kind of fades away to the eye. It almost looked more like Tom Cruise. And then he would step over her shoulder and it would cut to a different shot and it would look so much worse. I don't know if that was on purpose, like the way he was seeing himself within his own dreams.
Yeah, I don't know. Or
if that was just inconsistency with the makeup work.
Yeah, I don't know. I do see what you're saying, but I would not be shocked, I guess, if it was like something intentional, but I don't know. I'll have to find an interview with Crowe about it.
There are so many intentional things in this movie. The trivia page is just stacked with them. And so maybe, I don't know. I will say that wearing the mask on the back of his head is a creepy look. That's an effective creepy look. He spins around and there's another face just hanging out in his hair.
Then he uses it to like talk with a couple times.
But speaking of Tom Cruise's face, and this has nothing to do with the prosthetics or the makeup work, I just find Tom Cruise smiling to be very off-putting, to be very creepy. I don't like Tom Cruise in movies where he's smiling, where he's happy. It doesn't work for me at all. When he's serious, when he's intense, I'm good with it.
I could see that. It's a little maniacal, his smile. Yeah.
It feels like a mask. It feels like the mask of someone who's happy. And it's so that's why I could not give him my top performer.
Another fail that I had was the fact it felt when they started to reveal this life extension thing that we end up finding out that he sort of intentionally signed up for. We find that out, you know, later in the movie after the fact. Had this like off-putting, like Total Recall feel to it. It was like very like futuristic, but also felt like the 1980s at the same time. Like futuristic, like Back to the Future 2 assumed the future would look like.
Yes.
So yeah, it was just very like kind of just the office of the place felt like the office of the place in Total Recall. I don't know. It was.
Yeah, it did have a very Total Recall vibe.
I didn't care for it. I'm fine that it was a thing that they decided to put in, but I wish they would have, I don't know, somehow presented it differently.
Yeah, I had fails in there too. I wish tech support didn't have to explain everything. Like, I wish he would have discovered some things more organically than tech support. Tech support could be the final nail in the coffin, but he explains a lot in there. And it's cool reveal, but it could have been done in different ways. And then there's a lot of time between technically where the dream begins and the end of David's life. Like, tech support guy tells him he did a bunch of things. Like, he never sees Sophia after that night. He, like, becomes a hermit. He fixes his company. He gets rid of the seven dwarfs and fixes it and saves his company, but then gets really depressed.
Yeah, something like that.
I'm like, why wasn't any of that? If the movie had been bouncing back and forth, if those things had been taking place while the dream was taking place, then maybe. And then maybe I would have bought the explanation better at the end. But I like when things converge in a movie like this. In Total Recall, that's what happens. Like, everything converges into this explosion of action and tension.
Yeah. Yeah, they could have shown us more rather than just explaining to us what happened. One other success that I did have was I liked... I gave a success to Sophia... In general of what she like represented. So I thought she was, since she was kind of supposed to represent this, like, I don't want to say perfect, but this sort of, completely sweet, right? Lack of sour person or character. I thought she presented that well, 'cause she like checks the boxes of like, you know, she's pretty and she's kind of cute at the same time. And she's very sweet and nice. And so, like, I thought her, like, sort of being this goal or this treasure that he's trying to obtain and keep was, I thought that was represented well by her character.
Excellent. All right. So those are our successes and failures. Darren, enough about what we thought. Let's take a look at the Rotten Tomatoes reviewers, those top critics, and find out why Vanilla Sky ended up as a 42% on Rotten Tomatoes. What are you feeling? You feeling fresh or you feeling rotten?
Let's start with the fresh.
All right. So Christy Lemire from the Associated Press, she agrees with you. She says, Vanilla Sky is nearly identical to the 1997 Spanish film it's based on, except it's set in Manhattan instead of Madrid and has a much better soundtrack.
Man.
Yeah, Christy is with you. I will say that people found it weird. Let me get to another one here. David Anson, a Rotten Review, says the real mystery here is why a filmmaker as talented and unique as Crow would want to devote several years of his life to recreating someone else's movie. So this is a fairly authentic, a fairly faithful adaptation of that Spanish film. So I didn't watch the whole movie, but I watched the trailer first. I went, okay. And then I found, basically, if you've ever seen the YouTube clips thing, the movie clips channel on YouTube, where they just like take little 2-minute, 3-minute chunks of the movie. And so I started watching some of these scenes that we now know from Vanilla Sky, and it's really close. I mean, the movement of the camera sometimes is, you know, in Omar is faithful. The acting, even the clothing, even the pajama, wearing the pajama pants with no shirt, like that was what they did in the Spanish movie. It's very, very similar. So I found another one that was like identical was outside the police station when he kind of throws Brian against the wall or against the fence. They do the same move in the Spanish one where he takes his buddy and kind of throws him against a brick wall or a brick pillar. And I'm like, man, this is really identical. It must have been weird for Penelope Cruz.
Yeah. Just like having some deja vu. She's like, what? I guess maybe he just liked the movie enough that he thought it, you know, was worth doing an American or English version of it. I don't know.
Tom Cruise said that he gets offered sometimes to do remakes of foreign films, and he always turns them down because he feels like they're very tied to a place and time, that country of origin. Whereas he felt this story, and I believe he saw it at the Sundance Film Festival, this story seemed very evergreen. Could take place, could happen to anybody, could be set anywhere in the world, and that's kind of why he wanted to do it.
Interesting.
All right, another fresh review. Sarah Michelle Fetters from MovieFreak.com, she says, Vanilla Sky is one of the most challenging films of the year. It is thought-provoking, mysterious, complex, nerve-wracking, beautiful, creepy, funny, and a trip deliriously all its own. Did you feel challenged by Vanilla Sky?
I don't know. I don't know if I would say it, that's a word that I would use for this. It felt a little like a cluster F at times. Felt a little much, like there was a lot happening. I don't know. I don't think it challenged me. I don't think that would be a fair thing to say. What about you?
So I'm looking at the top grossing movies of 2001, and there are not a lot of challenging movies in 2001. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone was number one, followed by Shrek, Monsters, Inc., Rush Hour 2, The Mummy Returns, Pearl Harbor, Jurassic Park 3, Planet of the Apes, I'm guessing that's the Mark Wahlberg remake, Hannibal, The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Rings was number 10 in top grossing movies.
Huh.
American Pie 2, The Fast and the Furious came out that year. So maybe Hannibal was challenging. Maybe Monsters, Inc. is actually, I mean, makes you think. Those Pixar movies make you think.
Yeah, it's true.
And then what did I see on the list here? Legally Blonde, Spy Kids, Training
Spy Kids,
Day.
Spy Kids was deep.
Training Day. Training Day probably was a pretty challenging movie.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's going to get most challenging movie of the year. It was the number 35 on the top grossing movies. Right above Shallow Hal. A real challenging movie. So I don't know if it gets most challenging of the year, but I got to say it's a pretty shallow year for movies as far as big conceptual themes go. I don't know. I wouldn't say challenged either. It's not the adjective I would use. Thought-provoking, yes, but not challenging.
Sure, sure.
All right, let's take a look at some more Rotten Reviews. People got to be clever. They got to be funny. Stephen D. Gradanus from Decent Films Guide says, a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. The problem is the mystery and the enigma are in one movie and the riddle's in an entirely different movie. Have any thoughts on that?
Not really. I was hoping he was going to say something about vanilla, as in like boring. That's what I was hoping for.
What would be your critic pun that you would use?
I can't think of it off the top of my head.
All right, let's see. Let's get a real Rotten Review in here. Ooh, Rex Reed. This is cutting. From The Observer, he says, a good example of what self-destructive cinematic havoc can be wrought by handing over millions of dollars to movie stars to produce their own ego trips.
Dang.
Ooh, that is cutting. Was Tom Cruise on a little bit of an ego trip when he made himself the gorgeous Playboy centerpiece of this movie?
Yeah, I mean, I see how someone could think that or say that. But I mean, I also could see how he could argue that, like, he's trying to set up a stark contrast between what he is before the car crash and what he is after the car crash.
That might have been one of my problems. Does he change that much after the car crash?
Well, I mean, I think his life goes pretty downhill.
The scene at the nightclub is what messes me up. So the scene where he reveals himself to Sophia at the dance studio, which I can't tell if that is a dream or not.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
But he's very sweet. He's very nice. They have some witty banter. He says, I was having a bad hair day. It's a good joke. It's a good joke. But then he shows up to the nightclub and he's a monster. He's an absolute monster in the nightclub. And I couldn't figure out what was going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think maybe like, maybe the dance studio was a low pressure situation, but the nightclub in public and with all the people around felt more like pressure or more insecure about himself.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe that atmosphere. For Tom Cruise, look, I can't even tell you this was like a big year for Tom Cruise because he hasn't stopped. Look at his IMDb page. He hasn't stopped since 1983, Risky Business, The Outsiders. He hasn't stopped. His first movie was Endless Love in 81. But Top Gun is in the... You got all that run of 80s movies that lead you into the 90s and Days of Thunder and A Few Good Men and The Firm. Then you got Mission Impossible and Jerry Maguire in the mid-90s. Then in 99, you got Eyes Wide Shut, Magnolia, Mission Impossible 2 hits in 2000, and then Vanilla Sky, followed by Minority Report, a cameo in Austin Powers and Goldmember. And then The Last Samurai. Like, the dude hasn't stopped. There is not a gap in his IMDb page. There's no slow years for Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise has just been there our entire lives. Tom Cruise has been there churning out hit movie after hit movie.
It's true.
It's insane. So, yeah. So, I do remember at the time, though, people being a little bit like, has Tom Cruise, like, I don't want to use jump the shark, but like, is he finally made a flop? Has Tom Cruise finally flopped?
Yeah.
And I mean, that's why I didn't see Vanilla Sky back then. Yeah, I don't know.
And despite all this movie making, he still has time for Scientology.
Yeah.
What a guy.
We won't even get into that. All right, Darren, that does it for our Rotten Tomatoes reviewers. Thank you very much, reviewers. You are always entertaining. Now we've reached the segment in the show where Darren and I have to pitch a sequel. We have to pitch a sequel to a movie where the main character died and it's all a dream. Darren, what does he do? Is he clicking his heels together and saying there's no place like home? What do you pitch for your sequel?
I think I have a pretty good one here. Hear me out. So, the scene towards the almost the complete end of the movie, he conquers his fear of heights and he jumps off of a building, or we now know that he's in a dream though, so he's not really jumping off of a building, but it's still scary because it seems real. Mm-hmm. So my pitch is that it was real and the seven dwarves really were gaslighting him.
Ooh.
And it's a big conspiracy. So he actually jumped off the top of that building. I don't know if it was supposed to be the Empire State Building or whatever the hell it is.
Okay.
And dies.
Still oh no, that was much higher than the Empire State Building. They were taking the elevator from Willy Wonka.
Yeah, they were.
To the top floor of that building.
Yeah, they were. So he jumps off, kills himself. You know, it's in the news, obviously, because he's kind of well-known for having this
Playboy billionaire David Ames has just died in a horrible accident.
Yeah.
More exactly. At 11.
Exactly. You know, and it's easily explained because he was depressed over his car accident, blah, blah, blah. So the sequel is that we discover that it truly was a plot against him. And Penelope Cruz is still around and vows revenge on the board members and systematically takes all of them out in in a femme fatale style movie.
So she seduces all of these old men and one woman.
Yep.
And takes them out.
Yep. That's exactly correct. And she, in the name of David, takes over the company. At the end.
Oh my God. Hey, Penelope Cruz can do action. So I believe it.
Right?
Suspense.
Yeah.
I would like to tell you my pitch is going to be, not as weird as Darren's, but it's going to be just as weird. So here's my pitch. Now, the premise was that they could wake them up, right? Supposedly, medical technology got into the point that even though the fact that he committed suicide, they kept his brain alive and the body was frozen and they could just wake him up and he'd be 33 years old again.
And they'd fix his face and everything.
And they'd fix everything 150 years in the future.
Yeah.
So now, like I said, this is almost an exact remake of that Spanish movie, Open Your Eyes. My pitch is, we combine the cinematic universes. So David, Tom Cruise, and the Spanish actor who stars in Open Your Eyes both wake up at life extensions. They come out of their cryo chambers, as well as a mysterious woman wakes up too. And all three of them, they weren't supposed to wake up. That's not how the program's designed. The program is designed that you're supposed to jump and then it just restarts the dream.
Mm.
But they wake up and they have to figure out what's happened to them. They have to figure out what life extension is doing with them. Like what's really going on at life extension? And the life extension goons are chasing them. And so the three of them have to figure out the mystery of life extension and stop life extension's nefarious plot. Before they capture him back. And it's a love triangle. They both fall in love with the woman.
Oh. I like that we both created action movies. I like that.
Yeah, we did. I don't want Tom Cruise smiling. I want him serious.
That's okay. He's not even in my movie. Or he's only in it for a couple minutes, maybe.
It's true. You wrote him out. All right, Darren, that does it for our sequels. It is time to move on to quick picks. It's time for our nitpicks of the movie. It's time to pick out those last little details we loved. Darren, what do you got for me this week in quick picks?
First one I have was, I bet in 2001 that his TV was the coolest thing anyone's ever seen.
And his CD player.
Yeah. Yeah, his TV is super flat, and it goes up and down with a remote.
I think it goes into the floorboards.
Yeah, that's pretty fancy.
I love it. When Cameron Diaz pulls out that cell phone, that flip phone, I was like, oh, yeah, that was probably the coolest phone in 2001.
Heck, yeah.
I did like in that scene that he plucks out the gray hair. I feel like that's something Tom Cruise would do.
Yeah, for sure.
You know Tom Cruise has a thing about running, Darren, right?
What? He
loves
run?
Running. Loves oh, okay. it. In all his okay. movies, he's always running.
Okay.
Because to Tom Cruise, the only thing cooler than driving that Ferrari around Times Square, around an empty New York, would be Tom Cruise running through Times Square. I just love that he gets out of that car and has to run and sprint. And exactly how it happens in that Spanish movie.
Oh, really?
Including the car kind of jackknifing when it stops so that the camera can kind of spin around to the door and you get that hero shot of him coming out. It's like, no one would stop their car like that. You would just stop.
Which car did you like better? Did you like the Porsche or did you like the Mustang?
The Mustang. The blue one that they jump off the bridge?
Yeah. Oh, no. No, his car. So, right, so he has the dream in the beginning, and he's driving a
Ferrari
Porsche,
in the dream?
A Porsche, I think.
No, it's a Ferrari.
Is it a Ferrari? Okay.
Yeah.
He's driving a Ferrari, and then in real life, he drives a Mustang.
Interesting. I did not pick up on that there was a different car.
It was, yeah.
Oh, I thought you were talking about I like Cameron Diaz's car, the one that jump off the bridge.
Her car's cool, too.
It had like that old muscle car body to it.
Yeah, definitely. My next one was in the scene when he's approached by, when they're in the apartment, when they're in the second apartment, and Jason Lee's character comes up and they're like talking, and it like cuts away from him, and you're looking at Tom Cruise, and then it goes back, and Jason Lee looks like he moved like 25 feet in half a second. He looked like he teleported across the room. He's just suddenly right next to Tom Cruise. It's just the timing of the cuts made it look weird. I don't know.
Well, I had something from that scene that looked weird to me. Did you notice what was on Tom Cruise's desk? Like, he has a little office desk there in the corner of the room that he's kind of leaning against.
No, it was on the desk.
I'm guessing it was supposed to be a lamp. But it looked like a giant blue dildo. I'm sorry. I don't know what was up with the blue dildo lamp. And he had a bowl of Skittles on his desk.
Ooh, yummy.
I think it was Skittles. I couldn't tell if it was. If you were going to leave a bowl of candy on your desk, what are you leaving?
Yeah. I would leave Skittles before I leave M&M's.
Like M&M's melt in the mouth, Darren, not in the bowl.
I feel like they would. I feel like M&M's would attract insects before ants? Skittles. Yeah, before Skittles would.
All right, fair enough. So please, someone, set designer, tell me what was up with that lamp. Or if anyone in the late 90s, early 2000s had that lamp on their desk. I'm sure he'll claim it was a back massager. Sure it is, Tom. Sure.
It's an electric toothbrush. How about two people that meet who have excellent drawing skills? The two little portraits they do? Damn, I could not draw anything near that well.
I know. I could do a pretty convincing stick figure.
Yeah. Penelope Cruz could just quit whatever dancing thing she was doing and go be a caricature artist.
Oh, man, that's good. Speaking of art, the Monet painting that the movie takes its name from, Vanilla Sky, I had to check. You know, if they say something's a detail from the real world, I got to check. There is a Monet painting. It is called The Scene at Argentile, which is a town just outside of Paris. And apparently it was a very popular place for Monet to go paint. And the painting is not called Vanilla Sky. I don't know where I don't know if it's a nickname for the painting. I couldn't see anything on the actual like Wikipedia entry about the painting, but that's where they took the inspiration from. So it is a real painting.
Cool. My next one was that beret, the guy who like, was the owner or founder of Life Extension, I guess, perhaps. Okay. They're interviewing him on TV.
Yeah.
And then he's walking down the street in this blue beret and just like, what in the hell is this guy wearing? I would not trust a business whose owner was wearing such a beret.
See, I felt that way the first time Tom Cruise goes to his office. He's wearing that like... woman's like fisherman hat that's fuzzy. No one would wear that hat. It would look awful.
It was a weird hat. It was for sure. A
weird movie for hats. All right. We got to talk about pleasure delayers, Darren, because if I had known in college that this was a thing, I thought I was just being put in the friend zone over and over and over again. If I knew I could tell people that I was just a pleasure delayer.
Yeah. Then it would just people be like, oh, how innovative. Interesting.
That doesn't, you have to be like Chris Hemsworth levels of handsome to make that work.
Yeah. I'm just a pleasure delayer. I'm going to see my girlfriend in Canada next month.
All right. What else you got? What other quick picks you got for me?
I only got one more, but I absolutely love the exchange with the bartender in the nightclub. That was a great scene because, you know, you could tell that in the scene, David is just very pissed off, very self-conscious at that moment about everything. And the bartender won't look him in the eye when he initially orders. So the bartender, he kind of makes the bartender look him in the eye. And he's kind of a dick to him, right? But then the bartender comes right back. He's like, these are on the house. And he's like, why? He's like, and then he has like some line about like, it just is, bitch, or something like that. Cause Tom Cruise had called him a bitch. So I just like that he just like came right back and like wasn't put off by him at all. He's just like, boom, just like two sucker punches back and forth.
Because a bartender wouldn't look you in the eye, especially at a club like that. But they're not even looking. They're just hearing orders, right? They're just.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
First off, in a club like that, he's lucky as a male to have gotten that bartender's attention in the first place.
Yeah, I liked their exchange. It was good.
Do you think musicians drive around listening to their own CDs? Because that's what Cameron Diaz does in the movie.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe, you know, after it's freshly printed, you're going around checking it out.
I'll put it this way. You ever drive around listening to our own podcast?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, I know. Once or twice. I don't listen to every episode again. I listen to it again when I edit, but yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Once or twice I've tuned in to see if me and Darren are making you guys laugh as much as I feel like we're making you laugh.
Got anything else?
Yes, I've got one last nitpick. You are an a-hole if you date a girl that speaks a foreign language and you make zero effort to learn that foreign language. She storms off saying something in Spanish, and maybe it's Brian, looks at him. Yeah, Brian looks at him and is like, what did she say? And he's like, I have no idea. what an a-hole move. Like, if you're going to date someone who speaks a foreign language, you start picking it up. Come on, make the effort.
Yeah, it's very true.
All right. Those are all my quick picks. Darren, you want to? Oh, it's time for the lesson. It's time for the lesson on the No Myth Movies podcast.
The lesson's back.
Do you remember Kurt Russell talking about the five core emotions, the five base emotions?
Yeah, I feel like they were all sad except for love.
They were. Very pessimistic outlook on life. Well, I've looked it up, and depending on where you look, sometimes there's five, sometimes there's six, sometimes there's eight. But there is a general consensus that the human condition does have core or base emotions. The five that I found are joy, fear, sadness, disgust, and anger. Apparently, someone thinks those are the five.
Oh, there's only one. That's still only one nice one.
I know.
Joy.
Another one I found had six base emotions: anger, disgust, fear, happiness, sadness, surprise. Some paired them together like opposites. They're polar opposites. So joy, sadness, anger, fear, trust, distrust, surprise, anticipation. So this is an approved that's from Psychological Today. So
They didn't just make it up for the movie, is what you're saying?
No. Now, that's real psychology there. There are some base emotions that we all have.
Good.
All right. Trivia. I could do trivia for days on this movie. There is so much stuff. There's a website called theuncool.com, the official website for everything Cameron Crowe, a very dedicated website. And the people that manage this website have gone through and dissected and found everything in this movie. Every Beatles reference, all the numbers in this movie mean something. So everything's a secret code. So if you associate the number with that letter in the alphabet, like when he's getting his photo taken in prison and he's holding up his placard, if you translate the numbers into letters, it spells out something like the dream has become a nightmare.
Wow.
And there's all these things peppered in.
It's intense.
Yeah. So there are six basic theories, according to this website, on the meaning of the movie or where the dream begins and stuff like that. And one of them is what they're calling the Christian metaphors of the movie.
Oh.
So.
Not the Scientology metaphors?
Oh, no. No, no, no. There's a lot of stuff about the devil and making a deal with the devil. So he's asked many times, did he sign a contract?
Oh.
Lucid dream, Lucifer. they claim both women at Life Extension have red hair. Tilda Swinton apparently has a bottle of hot sauce behind her. They think that's a clue that she's the devil. And then there's things about David's Christ-likeness that apparently Christ died at 33 and David dies at 33 years old. His father wrote the book called Defending the Kingdom. And the magazine that he published is called Rise.
So it's all about the devil.
And Christ, apparently.
And Christ.
I didn't pick up on any of that. The deal with the devil. The deal with the devil, I can see. You just died, and now you're making a deal for your afterlife, basically. I can see that.
Yeah, yeah.
So literally, it would take me 45 minutes to get through all of the little things, the little details, the trivia in here. The one thing I will say is that if you look at the registration on his parking pass on his car, and this is in the Mustang, this is in the supposedly after the dream.
Okay.
The date that he needs to re-register his parking pass is February 30th, 2001.
Oh, I did read that piece of trivia.
Yeah, so they're saying that the whole thing has to be a dream because that date doesn't exist.
Right, 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 right.
All right, so yeah. So like I said, Beatles references, all sorts of things. It's pretty crazy. It's pretty crazy the details that people have gone into. The lines of dialogue that are homages to other things. Like the Mark Twain line, which is slightly tweaked, which is rumors of my death have been mildly exaggerated. I think isn't the Mark Twain line greatly exaggerated?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. If you want to dig in, theuncool.com has everything you would ever want to know about this movie.
Maybe if you play the whole movie backwards, it's like a demonic message.
The Paul is Dead had a lot of influence. I'm serious. Cameron Crowe is a huge Beatles fan. That's why they have that conversation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Which Beatle are you? All right. Darren, it is time for us to decide once and for all, Vanilla Sky, is it a good movie or is it a bad movie? What do you got?
You know, in the end, I decided this was a good movie. I actually, I enjoyed myself. It got a little, they went a little far, I think, with everything. And so it got a little confusing, and there was a lot of things happening at once that made it hard to follow. But overall, I was really entertained, and I was, you know, captivated by the movie. And so I was genuinely interested to see what was going to happen in the end and what the actual truth was going to be, et cetera, et cetera. Like I said, I wasn't a huge fan of the whole, like, Total Recall-y feeling thing. But yeah, I would say overall, I am putting this in my good movies box.
All right, there you go, Darren's decision. I am going to say, for me, yes, I was entertained. I found it to be an entertaining movie. I was captivated from beginning to end, but I'm going to say for me, this was a bad movie. When it comes down to it, when I really have to decide, there were too many things in the fail column for me. I felt like the trippiness of it was interesting, but I needed more. I needed more, maybe more panic from Tom Cruise. I actually think Tom Cruise is part of the reason why it was a fail, why it was a bad movie for me. I don't feel like he was convincing enough as the lead of like this what is happening to me kind of feeling. So things being a dream and things not being a dream, I did find it entertaining. Just like we said last week, I'm not regretting the experience of watching the movie. I can't say it's a good movie in the end when it all comes down to it.
It's fair. It's fair.
All right,
so
there we go.
So our first disagreement of season three.
Our first, I guess it's over then. No, we'll keep reviewing movies. Come on. I will say my wife agreed with you. She said good movie.
Oh, nice. Good.
Yeah. All right, Darren, that does it for Vanilla Sky, our first Tom Cruise movie of the year, celebrating its 20th anniversary. Congratulations, Vanilla Sky.
Happy birthday.
All right, Darren, coming up next week. Like we said, there are not a ton of things being released, but there is someone celebrating a birthday. On February 24th, famed actor Billy Zane.
Mm.
You may remember him from Zoolander. Billy Zane is celebrating a birthday. And what better time to watch a Billy Zane movie? No, not Titanic. We are going to be doing the superhero movie, The Phantom, which scores a 43% on Rotten Tomatoes and a 4.9 on IMDb. And I believe, when I last checked, is free on Crackle right now. So if you want to watch and catch up with us for next week, check out The Phantom on Crackle. This one's going to be interesting because I want to say it was in the early 90s. The movie came out in 96, so not as early in the 90s as I thought. And this is going to be interesting because this is pre-X-Men. This might even be pre-Blade.
Mm.
So as far as like comic book movies go, superhero movies go, this one's going to be pretty raw. So,
OG.
Yeah. This is going to be interesting to see where this one goes. So next week we will be doing Phantom. So tune in, join us, come back. We're here every Wednesday through the winter and spring, talking fun movies, interesting movies, meh movies, and giving you our decision on them if they're good or bad. All right, Darren, that does it for this episode. Thanks, everybody out there, for listening. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast on whatever app you are listening on. You can follow us on Twitter at No Meh Movies. You can follow me on Twitter at Davey Barris. Thanks for supporting the show, everyone. And the next time your friends ask about a movie, take a stance and tell them if the movie is good or bad. Because on this show, there are no meh movies.